As David said at the beginning, we're looking at the story of Joseph, and that is the story of God's rescue plan for his people. And in that, God uses the painful events of Joseph's life to achieve the rescue of his people. He's going to cover five sermons over the next 5 weeks, and we'll be looking at Genesis 37 to 41. It's a great passage, and it's a story which is very known very widely. Today's Genesis 37. Genesis 37. Now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. This is the history of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age. Also he made him a tunic of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Now Joseph had a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. So he said to them, "Please hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were, binding sheaves in the field. Then behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright, and indeed your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf." And his brothers said to him, "Shall you indeed reign over us, or shall you indeed have dominion over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Then he dreamed still another dream, and told it to his brothers and said, "Look, I have dreamed another dream, and this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me." So he told it to his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you?" And his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind. Then his brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." So he said to him, "Here I am." Then he said to him, "Please go and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks, and bring back word to me." So he sent him out of the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem. Now a certain man found him, and there he was, wandering in the field. And the man asked him, saying, "What are you seeking?" So he said, "I'm seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they are feeding their flocks." And the man said, "They have departed from here, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. Now when they saw him afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. Then they said to one another, "Look, this dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say, 'Some wild beast has devoured him.' We shall see what will become of his dreams." But Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, "Let us not kill him." And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood, but cast him into this pit, which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him, that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father." So it came to pass, when Joseph had come to his brothers, that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him. Then they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty. There was no water in it. And they sat down to eat a meal. Then they lifted their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels, bearing spices, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry them down to Egypt. So Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh." And his brothers listened. Then Midianite traders passed by, so the brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. Then Reuben returned to the pit, and indeed Joseph was not in the pit, and he tore his clothes. And he returned to his brothers and said, "The lad is no more, and I, where shall I go?" So they took Joseph's tunic, killed a kid of the goats, and dipped the tunic in the blood. Then they sent the tunic of many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, "We have found this. Do you know whether it is your son's tunic or not?" And he recognized it and said, "It is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Without doubt, Joseph is torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his waist, and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, "For I shall go down into the grave to my son in mourning." Thus his father wept for him. Now the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. I've called this talk, "God's plan is set in motion despite Joseph's dreams becoming nightmares." We're going to look at three points that all relate to God's plan for Joseph. So God's plan for Joseph, 1, is not known to Joseph. 2, uses broken people. And 3, points forward to Christ. So God's plan for Joseph is not known to Joseph. It uses broken people and it points forward to Christ. Now the important thing that we have to bear in mind here is that we know the end of this story, and that helps us to see what the events are doing in Joseph's life. Think of when you see a whodunit movie, a Poirot or something similar. The first time you watch it, you look carefully for the clues, you're trying to work out who the criminal is. You get to the end, maybe you're right, maybe you're wrong. The second time you watch that movie, it's obvious. You see all those points, it's very clear. Joseph did not know the end of this story. Which brings us to our first point today, that God's plan is not known to Joseph. Up until this point in Genesis, we're used to seeing a lot of explicit mentions of what God does and what he says to his people. But you may have noticed when we just read that passage, there's no mention of God at all. And at first glance, he doesn't appear to be speaking to his people in any way. It's the first major chapter of the Bible, if you don't mind me saying, where God is not mentioned. There's a few earlier chapters where they have explicit histories of certain people, but this is the first major chapter where God is not mentioned. Even Joseph's father, Jacob, had interactions with God, as recently as Genesis 35, 9-13, when God appeared to him and spoke to him, reaffirming the amazing promises he'd given to Abraham. God speaks to Joseph in a different way. He speaks to him through his dreams. First, the dream about the corn sheaves, where his brother's sheaves bow down to his sheaf. The corn is pointing forward to the impending famine in Canaan. Then a second dream where his brothers are stars bowing down to him, along with the sun and moon representing his mother and father. These dreams make his brothers absolutely furious. They can't contain themselves. Why should he, the second youngest of Jacob's children, be lording it over them? But his father Jacob, although he rebukes him, tellingly, if you look again at verse 11, he kept the matter in mind. Jacob knew that this was a message from God, and he knew that he must heed it. Remember that Jacob himself had experienced God-given dreams, seeing the stairway to heaven in Genesis 28. And his brothers were jealous, verse 11. So they knew at some level too that this was God's plan, even if they didn't like it. All Joseph really did here was have two dreams and relay them to his brothers. And people often state here that Joseph is brash or arrogant in the way that he delivers these messages, but the text doesn't actually tell us that at all. He simply relayed what God had shown him in his dream to them. God also provides the man in Shechem. Joseph was sent by his father to find his brothers 50 miles away, a huge distance to travel in that time. And it seems a reasonable assumption to make that Joseph would have been scared of his 11 brothers after the incident with the dreams and his father's obvious favoritism towards him. But he goes anyway. He obeys his father. Look again at verse 13. He says, "Here I am," meaning that he's going to do what his father wants him to do. The NIV translation is actually slightly clearer here. He says, "Very well." And if you look again at verse 15, he doesn't find them. At this point, you'd expect him to probably pack up his bags and return empty-handed to Jacob. This is before mobile phones or any modern way of finding people. It would have seemed a hopeless task for Joseph to find his brothers. And yet, a man finds Joseph wandering in the fields. This man had amazingly overheard the brothers talking about their plans to go to Dothan, another 15 miles away. That's about here to Acorn Street, actually, now that I think about it. This enabled Joseph to find his brothers. This event would have just seemed to be a completely normal event to any observer who was walking past. Nothing supernatural about it. One man wandering in a field speaks to another man, and then he heads off to a new place. But that man was in the right place at the right time because God had put him there. It kind of makes you wonder, doesn't it? Every time we witness a normal, potentially routine-looking event, it could be God sending someone off to do something really important, like Joseph. Or maybe one of us is that person sent by God to meet someone in the field. Joseph then finds his brothers. They strip him of his robe, and they beat him. They throw him into the empty pit. And then they casually have lunch while he cries out to them. How do we know they hear his cries? It tells us so in Genesis 42:21, when years later they're recounting the events of this story. It's a very cold-hearted act. And Reuben here, who is the oldest brother, shows flawed leadership. He should have been the default leader, being the oldest brother. And he hears the other brothers' evil plans to murder Joseph. And instead of stopping it outright, he comes up with a compromise, but a very poor compromise. A less evil plan to imprison him for a while and intending to rescue him later. But he's then away when the Ishmaelites, or the Midianite merchants, come past. God sends these people at precisely that moment to pass the brothers while their young brother sits in the pit. If during their long journey down to Egypt they had passed that pit a little while earlier, Joseph would not have been there. And a few hours later, and he would have been dead, or possibly pulled out of the pit by Reuben. The traders arrive, and Judah shows a nearly identical flawed leadership decision and decides, without knowing about Reuben's plan, that he would instead have his own slightly less evil plan of selling his brother and dressing it up as an act of kindness. Look at verse 27. "Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our own brother and our flesh." So in all these unconnected things, or seemingly unconnected things, the jealousy of his brothers, fueled by the robe, the dreams, the man in the field, and the Midianite merchants walking past at just the right time, all these seemingly unconnected and bad things were all part of God's plan, but Joseph would not have been able to see them. It's like being given a single piece of a 10,000 piece jigsaw puzzle that you've never seen. Imagine if I gave you that one piece and asked you to try to guess the overall picture from that one piece. It would be virtually impossible. So what's the relevance of this to us? We don't always see God's plan for us and how God is at work in our lives. We're staring at that single jigsaw piece, trying to extrapolate it to the whole jigsaw puzzle. We may not be able to comprehend God's plan, but he's working it out through us and through people we meet, including non-Christians. We might even be on our own march to Egypt in chains at the moment, not understanding how bad things happening to us can be part of God's plan. We have to trust him that he's working out his good plan through everything that happens to us. Isaiah 55:8-9 is helpful here. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. We don't really know how trusting Joseph was of God here. We don't really know much about his mindset and amongst all these things that are happening to him. And as we said earlier, he didn't know the end of the story. But we do know the end of our story because we've been told it through the Bible. Romans 8:28 says, we know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. We can even sometimes see decades later down the line why God works in a particular way in our lives. I can see how God worked in my life before I was saved. My wife and I were not Christians, and we moved to Hong Kong in 2002. My wife was a teacher, and she got a job at an international school, which just happened to be a Christian school. And neither of us particularly wanted that. We then spent 3 years there sort of puzzling about why these people were different to us, and that was subtly changing us. And then we decided to get a train home from Hong Kong to, effectively, to Berkhamsted, on the Trans-Siberian and then beyond. And God placed us in a cabin of four people. So it was me, my wife, and an American pastor working in Russia and another Christian. We then moved into a flat in London, 100 metres away from a Bible-believing church, which we didn't know was there. And a few months later, we came to the Lord. Neither of us could see either of those events, any of those events, directing us at the time. But God was gently guiding us to him. So the first point is that God's plan is not known to Joseph. And our application is that we need to trust God that whatever is happening to us in our lives is part of his good plan for us. Our second point this morning is that God's plan uses broken people. God's plan uses broken people. We know, because we know the end of the story, that everything that happens to Joseph, all of his suffering, is God's plan to take his people to Egypt, for them to flourish there during the famine, for them to multiply, and ultimately hundreds of years later to be led out of Egypt with Moses as their leader into the promised land. But let's just look back and think about what happened before this passage. God made a huge promise to Abraham in Genesis 15. That he would make him and his offspring into a great nation. But to human eyes, this must have seemed to be hanging on by a very thin line. Abraham's line continues through Isaac and then on to Jacob. Abraham had Ishmael, who was sent away and would not be part of God's holy people. And Isaac had two sons, Esau and Jacob. But Esau was not to form part of God's plan, God's holy people either. Out of him, we read in Genesis 36, the prior chapter, came the Edomites. And we don't hear about them again for a very long time until 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, when they're defeated first by King Saul and then by David. So God's promise to Abraham had passed through one son Isaac to one son Jacob. So now there must have been a huge sigh of relief when Jacob had a huge family, 12 sons and at least one daughter. But look again at verse 2. This says, this is the history of Jacob. At first glance, that's curious, isn't it? Because this is a story about Joseph, not Jacob. The ESV translation is slightly more helpful here. It says, these are the generations of Jacob. It's about Jacob's family rather than Jacob himself. I'm not a Hebrew scholar, so forgive me for that. But the word, the Hebrew word in the original text is toledoth, which means it means history or generations. And it's used throughout Genesis up to this point. We have the generations of Adam, the generations of Noah, and so on. After this use of generations of Jacob, the word Toledoth is not used again in the Old Testament. Why? It's because God's people are there, after there, referred to as the collective, the nation of Israel, God's chosen people. Israel was, of course, the name given to Jacob by God. And the next time Toledoth is used is in Matthew 1, when Matthew sets out Jesus' genealogy. The fact that this word is used again there indicates a change, something important has happened. So the generations of Jacob, the story of the nation of Israel, is a story of God's people from one Joseph to another Joseph, Jesus' earthly father. But despite the increase in the quantity of children through Jacob, the quality looks like it might be declining. This family appears to be really dysfunctional. So a few examples of that. Jacob had his children through two wives and two concubines. He showed extreme favoritism to Joseph, despite having witnessed that with his own father and Esau. His oldest son, Reuben, had slept with one of his concubines. And his second and third sons, Simeon and Levi, had slaughtered all the men in a city to repay the sin against their sister Dinah. And we've read in this chapter the brothers hated Joseph, and we've seen the flawed leadership from Reuben and Judah. Is this really God's chosen family? Well, this passage shows clearly how sin has taken root in this family. But God doesn't have an army of perfect people which he uses to carry out his plans exclusively. God uses broken people to carry out his plans. People like us, if you don't mind me saying. When God carries out his plan, he uses us to do it. And more importantly, God's plan is not stopped when broken people are doing their utmost to thwart their plans, his plans, like the brothers. It's very easy to look at ourselves as inadequate, not good enough to be an important part of God's plan. We might think that God has picked other people to do his work, but they're all broken people too. And God uses anyone and everyone to carry out his plans. We're all part of God's plan in the little and the big things that we do. So our second point this morning is that God's plan for Joseph uses broken people. Lastly today, our final point is that God's plan for Joseph points forward to Jesus. The Old Testament points to Jesus in many different ways. There are lots of prophecies of him throughout the Old Testament. And Jesus explains clearly to his disciples after his resurrection that the Old Testament is about him in Luke 24, 44 and 45. Joseph foreshadows Jesus. He's a type of Christ. We see this a great deal in the story of Joseph, which you'll see in subsequent weeks. But in Genesis 37 alone, we see that Joseph points us to Jesus several times. A few examples about Jesus that are mirrored here. Number one, Jesus, like Joseph, is his father's beloved son. This is my son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Number two, Jesus obeys his father even when asked to do something he doesn't want to do. Think of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. Father, if it is your will, take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. Joseph obeyed his father by going to Dothan, despite being scared. Number three, Jesus speaks God's word, which is perceived as arrogance or brashness. The Jewish leaders accused him of that many times. Joseph told his brothers about his God-given dreams. How else does Joseph point to Jesus? Number four, Jesus escapes death by going to Egypt as an infant. Number five, Jesus is betrayed for 30 pieces of silver. Joseph was 20, which represents several hundred years of inflation. And number six, Jesus' clothes were stripped from him before the crucifixion. Joseph was stripped of his robe by his brothers. So Joseph points us to Jesus, and we'll see in the next few weeks through the other studies that Joseph, the people around him, and the painful events that happened to him are the rescue plan that God has for his people in the face of an impending famine. And as we said at the beginning of Genesis 37, we know the end of the story, and we know the end of Jesus' story too. He gave himself as a sacrifice for many, as a ransom for many. He obeyed his father and went willingly to the cross so that we might live. Unlike in the story of Joseph, God did not use a broken person. Jesus was perfect, without sin. So when we read the story of Joseph, we should also see Jesus and how he fulfilled God's ultimate rescue plan, his final solution. Amen.